On this episode of Skeptico, President of the James Randi Educational Foundation, DJ Grothy.
There isn't scientific legitimacy to the JREF Million Dollar Challenge. I've talked to all these guys. None of them think it's legitimate. And maybe you can change that. Maybe as the new president and with your openness and your integrity, maybe you can usher in a new era where it does become something like the XPRIZE.
If some people conceive of the Million Dollar Challenge as the way science works, in other words, to advance our scientific understanding in this field, be challenged for $1 million. Well, that, you know, science is not a cage match, despite the fact that you put some big personality scientists in a room and they fight. Science doesn't work that way. The Million Dollar Challenge is done in the spirit of science. It's done looking at the evidence, but it is a vehicle of a nonprofit educational foundation to raise public consciousness and awareness about these important questions.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have an interview coming up with DJ Grothy, the new president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. DJ and I sat down and talked a couple weeks ago. We had a lot to talk about, including the science behind skepticism, the possibility that consciousness survives death, just what does constitute extraordinary proof, and of course, the JREF Million Dollar Challenge. It's a bit of a long interview. We just got going and we couldn't stop. But for those of you who are interested in skepticism and the skeptical movement, and I think that's most of the folks who listen to this show, I think you'll find the information very, very interesting. Here's my dialogue with DJ Grothy. We're joined today by someone whose skills as a broadcaster, journalist, and activist I greatly admire. Formerly the host of Point of Inquiry, DJ Grothy stood toe-to-toe with Nobel Prize winners, leading public intellectuals, and scores of best-selling authors. And he not only held his own, but he brought a depth and a command of the topics that was, well, was pretty darn impressive. Now, you notice that I use the word formally, because DJ has taken a new job. He's now the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, many of you know as JREF. And it's in that role that we welcome today DJ Grothy. Welcome back to Skeptico.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be back on the show. Always enjoy our conversations.
Good. So, as I just mentioned, DJ, you're a newly minted president of JREF. Actually, it's been a couple months now. But let me, for folks who maybe don't know too much about JREF, let me read to you the description I got from the JREF website, because I found it, well, refreshingly straightforward and concise, and here it is: a nonprofit foundation headed by a professional magician exposes psychics, faith healers, and such. Perhaps you want to flesh that out a little bit and tell folks what JREF is.
The big answer is it's an educational nonprofit founded by James Randi, who is this public intellectual and magician, as you mentioned, really the leading figure in the history of organized skepticism, grassroots skepticism, you know, people who get their righteous indignation up when there are hucksters or possibly frauds or charlatans out there making claims that aren't substantiated and that can do harm to believers. Well, Randi started all of this, and the James Randi Educational Foundation is his educational nonprofit. Our goal is not just to expose frauds, though, it should be said. We're an educational nonprofit committed to advancing critical thinking in general, and also specifically about the supernatural, about the paranormal, about pseudoscience claims. And it should be said that not all of those claims will involve frauds or charlatans. Sometimes it's just junk science or self-deceived folks. So I want to offer that clarification.
Fine. And, you know, so let me jump right into this, because you're taking over as the president of it. And when I heard that, I guess I was really first quite surprised. And I guess I also thought, are you up for it? And let me ask you that question. Are you up for it? But let me kind of frame that up a little bit and let you know what I mean, because certainly you have the intellectual skills, you have the communication skills for the job, but I think you're heading into different waters. You know, in Point of Inquiry, you came at that with an intellectual force and a command of the issues, and also, I think, an acceptance by your audience that the secular humanist position was, you know, morally and intellectually correct. You know, so you used to cover separation of church and state, evolution versus creationism, human rights, all that kind of stuff. But now you're being asked to be the voice of authority on issues of science and issues where the skeptical community in general and the James Randi Educational Foundation in particular, well, their position is a little bit more murky in terms of where the public stands and where intellectuals and scientists stand. So in that sense, are you up for being the president of JRA?
That's a good question, hard question, if I wasn't up for it. But the good news is I am up for it. More than that, it is form-fitting. It is, you know, if there were a master of the universe try to create a job that fit DJ Grothy perfectly, it would be this. Why? Because, well, not only am I a former magician, but I have the same values and the same commitments that James Randi and the foundation seeks to advance. And it's not so different. There are some clarifications. I'll offer those. But it's not so different from the agenda of one of the component organizations of the Center for Inquiry, and that's SICOP, or I guess now it's called the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. The skeptical nonprofit that is housed at CFI was co-founded by James Randi back in the 70s. Also, folks like Isaac Asimov, Carl Sagan, Paul Kurtz, others. So I've always been motivated by this kind of mission to advance critical thinking about untested claims in an open-minded way. There seemed to be an implication in your question that the JREF, well, you used the term murky or something like that, but that the JREF may be less than open-minded. I'm here to tell you that it's our job, it's my job, to make sure that as regards any of these paranormal, pseudoscientific, supernatural claims, that we approach them in an open-minded and a fair-minded way, but that doesn't mean just because we're tender-hearted that we're kind of soft-headed. In other words, we could be rigorous, critical, but do that in a fair-minded way.
I think that's the positive part I saw in terms of you becoming president of JREF. I think you bring that kind of credibility, at least in my mind, in terms of being a consumer of your broadcast on Point of Inquiry. I found you to be very open-minded and very fair-minded on the issue, even though you clearly had a position and you had a point of view.
I appreciate hearing that, and I not only do I pride myself, Alex, on my humility, that's a joke, I also pride myself on the qualities that you just mentioned, that, you know, I consider myself to be an open-minded, fair-minded guy. I should also say that in the history of the James Randi Educational Foundation, we have approached all sorts of untested claims, I think, in fair-minded ways. Of course, because the JREF is doing something no other international nonprofit is doing, which is engaging head-on claimants, it's always going to be a little more controversial than if we're just sitting in our armchairs and kind of spouting off from the ivory tower. Instead, we're rolling up our sleeves. James Randi is really the model here of rolling up his sleeves and getting his hands in the nitty-gritty of these kinds of claims, really testing to see if these claims, various claims, supernatural, paranormal, pseudoscientific claims, are real. And that's what I think sets the JREF apart. So we're similar to other national nonprofit skeptical organizations in that we care about the same issues. We're different in that we, you know, that we are engaging some of these things head on and not just writing our opinions out there, but instead we're really trying to challenge claimants in the hope of ferreting out the truth, which is something both sides of any of these controversial issues should care about. The truth is what should matter. So when we say we will give you $1 million if you can prove X, Y, or Z under mutually agreed upon scientific conditions, you know, I think a claimant should jump at that and know that It's all done in the spirit of finding out the truth. The truth matters at the JREF. It's not just a matter of each person kind of having his or her own beliefs and everybody playing nice and going home and not really engaging. We want to engage.
Again, a laudable position, but we have to put it to the test a little bit. We'll talk about the $1 million challenge in just a minute, but let's back up, because I think even before we can get to the $1 million challenge, we have to deal with the science behind these claims, these controversial claims that we're talking about. And it sounds like you are willing and ready to engage in a substantive dialogue about the science. And I hope that that's what you'll do. And I suspect that's what you'll do on your show as well. But are you personally ready to engage in that? Hey, you know, because if you are, well, that's what Skeptico deals with every episode. We have, you know, the top researchers come on and talk about these things. So, you know, are you going to be able to talk about survival of consciousness? Are you going to be able to talk about the best researchers out there vis-a-vis the skeptical position? Because before we can talk about the prize, which I do want to talk about, we have to talk about the science, don't we?
Definitely. And the science, or more broadly construed, the evidence is what matters. So, as you know, from Point of Inquiry, which I'm glad to echo your own comments, it was a popular show, garnered a really large audience of people who enjoyed engaging, call it the cultural competition. So it wasn't just people who believed with the point of view of Point of Inquiry who were on the show, but we had all sorts of folks on, and we enjoyed having important dialogues on these issues. I plan fully for that to continue with the JREF's new show, For Good Reason, which I'll be hosting. For Good Reason will, I anticipate, have on it all comers, people who want to discuss the best evidence for the survival of consciousness after death. Well, let's have that conversation. It is one of the most important conversations we can have. Ghosts, do they exist? I think that's not a trivial question. It's an important conversation. It really touches to the core of so many of the central issues kind of that should get us up in the morning.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that is really the place where the JREF and the skeptical community and the loyal opposition, which I consider myself part of, you know, really join forces, because we're all very intensely interested in the questions.
Right.
Because most people go through their day without really giving a lot of thought to these very important fundamental questions.
We may not agree on the answers. In fact, from conversations I've had with you, I know that we don't agree on all the answers, but we agree that the questions are important. Most believers don't, if you'll allow me to paint with a broad brush stroke here, most believers don't take the claims even all that seriously. They watch Ghost Hunters, or they, you know, get their paranormal fix on TV, and they just walk around believing. But that's not the same thing as a sincere investigator who believes these claims, but really earnestly looks at the evidence. And that's the position I think skeptics and believers alike should take. And so you're right, Alex. In that sense, the non-skeptical community? That almost sounds like an insult. But the believer community, right, the paranormal world and the skeptical world can join in common cause, saying these questions are important. We may disagree on the answers, but the questions are important. And if we engage the questions sincerely, I think we can all only benefit.
Okay. Well, let's dive in a little bit, and you can pull back at any point you want, but let's dive in a little bit and talk about survival of consciousness, because as you mentioned, from a scientific standpoint, it is at the core of so many of the paranormal and what you would call supernatural experiences that you care about. So if you're talking about psychics, you're talking about ghosts, you're talking about a number of those things, what it really hinges on is it possible that our consciousness, in whatever way that we might not fully understand, is it possible that consciousness survives death?
Right. When you die, are you still alive? That's the big survival of death question or issue. And it is the foundation question of so much else that's going on in the paranormal. You look at the history of parapsychological research, Alex, you look at, say, J.B. Rhine. who at University of Chicago, your listeners may know J.B. Ryan as the founder of the whole academic field of parapsychology at Duke University. Well, when he was in Chicago at school, he was a naturalist, not a supernaturalist. He was a Darwinian. He kind of was steeped in the views that said there is no survival of consciousness after death. And let me tell you, that didn't sit well with him. That mucked with his psychology. You read the documentary evidence in his journals and his writing. You see that this was a formative period where he said, I want none of that. I really want to apply my scientific life to see if I can't prove that that consciousness can be outside of the body, right? Which then would prove survival of the soul after death. He had an agenda, and I don't fault him for that, because I think he actually gets kind of a bad rap from a lot of skeptics as being woo-woo or goofy or not a real scientist. He was a real scientist. It just so happened he was a real scientist with an agenda. You see, though, that agenda is what fueled his research. He wanted to prove that the soul survives death, and from that we got this whole field.
But also, I don't want to get into the whole history of it, but also he really earned his stripes as a debunker, debunking a very famous psychic of the time. So he really was a true researcher. But again, I don't want to get into
exactly. You're absolutely right about that. He wasn't a charlatan himself. He may have had his biases, but Alex, don't we all have our biases? He did real research that holds up if you look at it. Note that he never said, my research proves ESP, my research proves in scientifically verifiable and replicable ways the survival of the soul after death, etc. But I'm just saying his research methods weren't complete disasters. They had something to commend for them.
Well, and what fascinates me and drives me more is more of the current research. And I guess when you talk about survival of consciousness, the first area that I'd go is near-death experience research, because it's the place where we have the most intellectually forceful, scientifically based, medically based evidence of survival of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, I assume from where you're sitting today that you don't ascribe to that. So what skeptical explanation do you give for the near-death experience phenomena? Because we've had a bunch of these folks on the show over the last month, and we've just explored just about every skeptical angle I think we can get our hands on. So where are you coming from on the near-death experience phenomena?
Well, I wasn't on the show to talk about NDEs. I think it's an important topic, so we could touch on it briefly now. If you look at the field of near-death experience research, you see that there are a lot of researchers who believe in the survival of consciousness after death, who disagree both on mechanism, kind of just on the process, right? So there are different, I'd call it quasi or pseudoscientific explanations for the survival of consciousness after death. There's debate within the non-skeptical community, in other words, the believer or the paranormal community, about how it happens and what exactly is happening. Is it something like astral projection? Is it the little homunculus, the little self that is me that survives death? Is it a more cosmic consciousness that I'm tapping into? There's debate. It could be more New Age or less New Age. It could sound more scientific or less scientific, but the point is there's debate. As a skeptic, I am not close-minded. I would love, in fact, by definition, skeptic, at least according to my definition, and I think the working definition of skeptic, skeptic is the opposite of closed-minded. It's open-minded inquiry. In fact, if you look at the origin of the word skeptical, it comes from skepticos, as you know. It means just to inquire or to look into. So as a skeptic, I think we should look into these claims even over and over again. But at some point, you say, after decades of research into this, if there's no compelling evidence, we can safely conclude it's time to move on. I'm not sure that we're at that point yet, but maybe, and I have to concede this point, Alex, maybe that's just because I'm kind of young at this. You know, I haven't spent decades looking at this research. I know other researchers have who have a skeptical view of the claims. So
Who would you point to, DJ? And again, we don't have to, I don't want to monopolize the conversation on this. It's just something we've delved into quite a bit. You know, you like Michael Persinger's explanation, God Helmet. We've had him on the show. Then we had an EEG expert come on who is also a skeptic, but kind of totally refuted Persinger's
right.
claim that the EEG only met, that the only explanation for a near-death experience during a time when someone has a flat EEG is uh-huh. that the brain activity being measured by the EEG isn't measuring everything that's going on. Anyways, that's Persinger's explanation. It doesn't stand up. You like Kevin Nelson's explanation, REM intrusion, we had him on. You like Susan Blackmore's explanation of the tunnel, we had him on. Michael Shermer, we haven't had on a long time, but we had him on, and we have none of these hold up to any kind of reasonable analysis. And then we've also had the NDE proponents on. To me, uh-huh. it's a clear-cut case of where the skeptical community just isn't engaging with the data. So all the nice talk we had before about open-minded and seeking the truth is all great, but it only matters when we put it into practice.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. You said a lot there, so I'm going to try to kind of grab onto a few of the points. One, yes, you have to engage with the claims. You can't just say, oh, I'm open-minded, and then in practice be closed-minded. It's a no-brainer. You don't want to act like that. I agree with you there. You mentioned a few kind of skeptical, dismissive approaches or ways of looking at these claims that
just explanations.
Dismiss them.
No. And it's not dismissive. It's explanations. So that these
okay.
are folks legitimately. Michael Persinger at Laurentian University, I think he's quite an intelligent guy, and I enjoyed the dialogue with him. He's not at all flaky. He's a hard worker. He publishes uh-huh. like crazy. He just has an explanation for what's happening during the near-death experience because he realizes it's a game changer, just like you
uh-huh.
said there. If there is survival of consciousness, we have to look at everything differently. And I'm just offering up, when I talk to skeptics, these are the four people they pull out. They either say Persinger,
right.
or they say Kevin Nelson, or they say Susan Blackmore, or they say Michael Shermer. And so I'm just saying that's the skeptical explanation for near-death experience.
Alex, I'm glad that I misunderstood you and that you weren't implying these folks were dismissing. Instead, they were offering explanations, and that's really the best thing about science. Number of people can offer explanations that hold water or don't. You appear to think they don't hold water, but if they don't hold water, and you and I aren't on the same page as regards that position, if they don't hold water, it doesn't follow that they are not engaging the subject. In fact, by definition, they are engaging the topic, maybe not to your satisfactions. The thinking along those lines that say I like most, and at this point it's just a matter of what I like and what I don't like. I'm not a neuroscientist, and I haven't invested decades of scientific research in this. You know, I'm a, can I use the phrase ardent and sincere hobbyist in a sense like you. You're a person who's interested in these topics. You're up on them. You read them, but you're not a neuroscientist actively engaged in the field. Person I like a lot, and her explanations in this regard are Susan Blackmore. That said, I don't think all of the research has been done on this, and I think more research needs to be done. But the research I would call for would probably have a different shape and form than the research you would call for. So if you're going to look into the NDE claims, are you going to go to a skeptical or believing neurologist, or are you going to go to a New Age practitioner who offers past life regression seminars. And the problem with the paranormal community, one problem I see, is that there's not really a standard by which you judge someone's authority in a field, kind of street cred or bona fides, whatever word you want to use.
Of course there is. I mean, maybe if you paint it in those kind of broad terms, I mean, you can say anything you want. But when you get down to the particulars, it's the same standard that we all use. It's are you associated with a major research institution or university? Do you publish in peer-reviewed journals? I mean, these are the standards by which everyone is judged. So I don't know who
I love hearing you say something along those lines, but you know that you're jutting up against a whole lot else going on in the paranormal world, where you may say, I'll only listen to people who are at degree-granting research institutions who are actually doing research, but you know, a lot of folks who may believe what you're selling, you know, the NDE idea, will also be listening to folks who, from your own vantage, by your own admission just now, have no business speaking out about it or offering explanations or teaching people about it. So you might not ever be caught dead at a psychic fair. You might not be caught dead at, you know, it's funny we're talking about near-death experiences and I'm using the phrase caught dead at, but you might not show up at a seminar on astral projection, because you, even as a believer in the survival of the soul after death, may rightly think those guys are hucksters, those folks are charlatans or self-deceived. But you surely have to admit that you're unique in this regard, or let's at least say in the minority among people who believe in this sort of stuff.
I don't agree with what you're saying, because you kind of painted such a mosaic there of different ideas. But I think it really gets to the problem that so many people have, so many of the people that I know who are serious about the research have with JREF or have with the skeptical community. And that's kind of a misunderstanding of really what the moral center is, you know? So here we started off with a discussion on the science of near-death experience. And we'll leave that now because, you know, maybe we've covered it as far as we can. But I'd really like to see some skeptical explanation that merits serious consideration for any of these other claims. They don't stand up. And so you can paint it and say, well, you know, I like Susan Blackmore. Susan Blackmore's explanation makes no sense. So we could go talk to all the neurologists without asking about near-death experience, but we could ask them about Susan Blackmore's explanation, and they tell you it doesn't make any sense. The same, and I did, because I did. And I also did with Kevin Nelson, and I did with Michael Persinger. None of them make any sense. There is no there in terms of the science for a skeptical explanation of things. And
let me just jump in and talk about this in regards of evidence. You're suggesting that Susan Blackmore or Persinger or others, and I am partial to Susan Blackmore's take on this, given just where I'm at on the topic. You've suggested that they need to proffer a sufficient explanation for near-death experiences, or else you're forced to believe that the near-death experiences are evidence of something supernatural or paranormal or survival of the soul after death, etc. That's not my take on how science works. Science,
of course it is. Of course it is. DJ, hold on. When you have someone like Pin Van Lommel, who does a 10-year retrospective study, publishes it in one of the most highly regarded medical journals in the world, The Lancet, and that's accepted as research that's highly suggestive that consciousness survives death, that becomes one brick in the wall that someone is building for this theory. Now, as more and more people add more bricks, it becomes the theory that needs to be knocked down by someone else. So we can't play this game of, you know, it's the burden of proof is on you. No, the burden of proof is on you. No, the burden of proof is on you. So, and anyone who makes a claim, a skeptical claim, for example,
Kevin Nelson was on the show a while back from the University of Kentucky, very skeptical guy. When he goes out and says that REM intrusion, that process of kind of almost being awake, is an explanation for the near-death experience, that is a claim. It's not a counterclaim that therefore doesn't require the same level of proof. No, it's a scientific claim. So if that claim gets shot down, well, then that advances the claim that it was trying to shoot down. That's how science
actually
works.
Actually, I was with you right until the last clause of that sentence, okay? So just because one person advances a view of the universe, of the solar system that's not heliocentrism, and another person advances another one that's not heliocentrism, you can shoot one down, and it doesn't mean that both of the remaining views are therefore supported.
Right.
It only means that the view that's shot down is not supported. So so I was with you right until that last clause. You're right. If a skeptic makes a claim explaining a phenomenon, then it has to be substantiated. If it's not, it should be dismissed. That's the glory of science. You know, the best ideas rise to the top. But if a skeptical idea can't stand on its own, it does not follow, therefore, that the non-skeptical or the paranormal view, therefore, is substantiated. There's no connection between those two epistemologically. It only means that one set of claims was not substantiated and the other either wasn't substantiated or hasn't yet been proven, right?
I'm with you, except in this case that we're talking about in particular, and then we'll leave near-death experience alone. In this case, there's a substantial amount of evidence of the theory that consciousness survives death. So you do have to overcome that. At some point, it does pile up.
One last question on this, and I know you didn't have me on the show to talk about it, but I love this topic, and I look forward to getting into it much more in my career and in conversations with you and others. I think it's really, as I mentioned earlier, the foundation question, right? It's the thing that so many other paranormal claims are wrapped around in. And therefore, I want to take it head on. And if there's evidence that the soul survives death, you know, I want to be the first person to buy into it if it's real evidence and merits my attention, because I would love the hell out of the idea that the soul survives death. I'm just not going to look to the Bible as evidence or anecdotal experience as evidence, the same kind as the evidence that suggests otherwise coming from the cognitive neurosciences. So back to this, you know, just the one last point I wanted to make, or I guess ask you a pointed question about NDEs. Do you believe, are you saying, it sounded like you were, that the scientific evidence, and you use that word a lot, and I like the word, that the scientific evidence is growing for NDEs, or is it overwhelming? Is the case closed? Is it a new science? I guess what I'm asking is, the evidence we have for survival of the soul after death, or even survival of the soul, is it as complete as, say, the evidence that we have for evolution, or the evidence that we have for Newtonian physics, et cetera? Is it, or quantum physics, if you want to have a conversation with someone else about it?
Well, I think
in other words, is the body of knowledge that comprehensive?
I think the body of knowledge is quite comprehensive, with literally over 100 published research articles that support the idea, are highly suggestive, the term that scientists like to use, highly suggestive, mm-hmm. that consciousness in some way that we don't completely understand survives our bodily death. And the best evidence of that is that we have people that are being monitored because they have some kind of medical emergency, and we have an EEG hooked up to their head, and we have an EKG hooked up to their heart, and maybe they're even under heavy anesthesia. And then they have these remembrances, these experiences
that when they come back, and we have them over and over and over again, and we have the medical knowledge to know that they didn't have any brain functioning. And we know that those two things, we don't know, but the best evidence strongly suggests that those two things are happening together. Flat EEG and some kind of conscious experience that we're calling near-death experience, those things are happening at the same time. So that's really the crux of it.
Yeah, I haven't followed that evidence. I'm not persuaded by the anecdotes there, but I'm open-minded. And if you said there's 100, let's say, papers, that sounds like a big number. That's actually a very small number in science, very small number. But well,
it depends on the field, right? And it depends on the quality of the
If it's a new field, and that's what I was asking at earlier. If it's a new field, 100 is a good number to suggest further research. But you have to concede then that it's a new field and that there's not a body of evidence that is completely nail in the coffin persuasive. It's a new field and there are questions that merit our attention. At least you seem to be admitting it's a new field and it's not conclusive. It's suggestive for you. I think scientists should get involved in this. If it's their research field, they should look into the questions more. I think the questions deserve research, but a paranormalist can't say, oh, science has proven it, because I don't think either you nor I can say, finally, science has proven the survival of the soul after death. If that's your claim, then we have to kind of start our conversation over and go back to basics. I don't think that's your claim.
See, I think it gets back to that kind of almost goes into a philosophical discussion. I think we can keep it in real simple terms the way you did earlier in the conversation. It's about seeking the truth. And if we're going to be on the edge of seeking the truth, then we have to be comfortable with dealing in these murky waters where things aren't perfectly clear. And I think that's
so true. So true. I could not agree more. And this is the distinction between fringe science, some of which I believe in, I'll say that as president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, and pseudoscience, which is a different thing entirely. And we stand critical of pseudoscience, which is kind of fake science, quasi-science, that makes claims that aren't substantiated by science or by the best methods of science or the body of knowledge we call science. It's not consistent with what we know about the universe. That's pseudoscience. Fringe science is just new science on the fringes, on the cutting edges. If there are legitimate consciousness studies, kind of scientific research projects, by scientists, I think some of those would fall into the fringe category. Some of those may well fall into the pseudoscience category. This is equally true about some of the new science coming out that might be broadly construed as transhumanism, or some of the radical life extension work of folks like Aubrey de Grey and others. I would consider him a fringe scientist or kind of on the cutting edge, not a pseudoscientist, but my gosh, there are skeptics who say, how dare you even read one of his books and be excited about the prospect, because he is not consensus science. So I'm generally persuaded by consensus in the sciences, understanding that consensus should be overturned by new evidence. That's the whole way science progresses. You touched on that earlier. But I'm not automatically opposed to science on the cutting edge or science on the fringes. And if all you're suggesting, Alex, is this uncontroversial claim that some research in consciousness studies or the survival of the soul after death is on the fringes of science, I can't disagree with you on that point.
Well, let's back up, and because you mentioned a word that really kind of stirs me in a way, and that's this claim of pseudoscience, because so many times I've encountered skeptics who haul that out as some label, some magic wand that they can automatically wave across some idea that they don't like, and it'll therefore go away. And let's take people.
Yeah, I don't like that either. That's kind of an epithet, an insult we give to, or some skeptics give to, ideas that don't work for them, to sound very POMO, postmodern, about it, and I'm certainly not postmodernist in regards to claims of knowledge. But you don't deny that there is such a thing as pseudoscience.
By definition, there is. But let's bring it, I want to kind of focus the, direct the conversation over to one of the folks who I think we would probably agree is one of the more prominent skeptical researchers. He's a guy who makes the circuit on your conferences and on very popular, especially in the UK, and that's Dr. Richard Wiseman, who, of course, you're familiar with.
Yeah, I love Richard, and you know, I want to kind of remind myself that I wasn't on the show to give reports on my views on various researchers or thinkers. But, I'm fine to have those conversations,
right?
But,
right. No, well, I'm not trying to put you on the spot on any particular position he's taken, but on the broader position, because I think it gets to the intellectual core or lack thereof of the skeptical position. Here's the quote from Richard Wiseman, and if you don't want to respond to this, you don't have to. But I think you'll have an opinion on this. I think you will. And this was in the UK's Daily Mail. He said, "I agree that by the standards of any other area of science, that remote viewing is proven. But that begs the question: do we need higher standards of evidence when we study the paranormal?" Now, in a later interview, clarifying that on September 28th, 2009, here was his clarification. It was a slight misquote, because I was using the term in a more general sense of ESP. That is, I wasn't just talking about remote viewing per se, but rather Ganzfeld, mm-hmm. etc. I mm-hmm. think mm-hmm. that they do meet the usual standards for a normal claim, but are not convincing enough for an extraordinary claim. So the question for you is, what business are you in? Are you in the business of extraordinary claim business, or are you in the business of where is the science really going? And in that sense, where is the intellectual force behind JREF, behind the skeptical community? Because if it is the Better Business Bureau for psychics and fraudulent claims, then that's great. You know, if you want to just go find the psychics who are really ripping people off, or the past life regression people who are ripping people off, and that's where you're at, then that's great. But if you're going to continue to make basically what are scientific position statements and saying that we don't believe there is any there when it comes to these claims, well, then I think you're undermined by some of the very people that you point to as being the luminaries, like Richard Wiseman, who says, hey, this stuff has basically already been proven.
Well, to be clear on Weissman's quote, first of all, in its entirety and with his clarification, I agree. That said, let me tell you how I agree. There is, in the history of parapsychological research, some lines of evidence to suggest there's something going on there. You mentioned Ganzfeld. There, you know, might be a couple others. And the expert here is Ray Hyman, a statistician, a friend. Maybe this is a mischaracterization, but from my vantage, he's a friend of the parapsychology set, even as he's a skeptic, because he's so damned fair-minded, and he's corrected the skeptical community a number of times when they've
That's not been my experience, but go ahead. We're familiar with Ray Hyman, and we've delved into his work a little bit. But he's never agreed to come on and face face Dean Radin, or face any of the folks who don't feel the way that you do. But go ahead. Let's take him out.
Well, and I think some of that has to do with, you know, that he's pretty media savvy and doesn't want to. We don't have to guess at people's motivations, but I will. How do you like that? I think Hyman just doesn't want to engage certain kinds of claimants, and he's much more interested in a subset of parapsychologists who kind of, without wanting publicity and without trying to sell their books or any of that stuff, they're just quietly doing their research. And he's done some of the big studies of in a big way of a number of these parapsychology research projects. The reason I brought him up was that he suggests to me the right approach of the skeptical community, which is to not in a knee-jerk way dismiss every project of research in parapsychology. And there are skeptics, you may know of some, who would say, oh my God, we know there's no such thing as ghosts, so there's no reason to go investigate it. We know there's no such thing as psychics, so there's no reason to have that research project. I think that's the wrong approach. In fact, I don't think that's skeptical at all. I think that's kind of cynical, kind of knee-jerk. You know, I call these folks knee-jerks, right? Because it's a kind of a jerky way that they kind of automatically assume there's not going to be any reason to do that research. What Weissman was getting at, or what I guess he was getting at, I haven't spoken with him about this quote that you pulled out of a paper and asked me about, is that psychic claims, ESP claims, are not run-of-the-mill claims. They're not the kinds of claims that you have low standards of evidence like you would in any research paper where you just want something to suggest this or that. You know, as you were talking about earlier, no NDE researcher has said, aha, I've published a paper that conclusively proves the survival of the soul after death. They couch their terms, as scientists do, in more tentative language, and they say, this suggests this possibility, here's a reason for further research, etc. When you're dealing with extraordinary claims, I think you want to be extra special, rigorous in your research. You want to have even higher standards of evidence because of the implications of widespread credulity in that claim. So an example here is the Wakefield study on vaccines published a number of years ago in The Lancet. You mentioned Lancet earlier. It took The Lancet all these years. They just retracted that paper a couple days ago, the autism paper, that really set off this frenzied movement of activists who mean well but don't do well, who believe that vaccines have some relationship to autism. You know, you have the Jenny MacArthur set, or Jenny McCarthy, I guess, but I don't know. She's a little MacArthur in some ways as well.
Interesting.
So she and her ilk are fueled by this seemingly legitimate research paper published in The Lancet that The Lancet finally retracted because they said, oh, shoddy evidence, we were wrong to publish it, didn't belong in our paper, I mean, in our journal. It should have high standards of evidence for kinds of claims that if widely believed in would or could negatively impact folks.
Okay, now, DJ, so hold on. You've done a better job of defending Weissman's quote than anyone I've heard, so I have to give you kudos for that. Now, but first, let me back up and kind of fill in a little bit on the Ray Hyman thing. First of all, Ray Hyman...
Ray Hyman. I love him, but I didn't come on the show to debate
him. But you just made... You just said some things about Ray Hyman, and then I just need to say these, and then we'll just move on real quickly. But I'll give you the background. So Ray Hyman was on a skeptical show, you know it, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, specifically talking about some research. We really dug into that research. We had the researcher, Dean Radin, come on and show how Hyman was directly contradicted by the published research. It's really, there isn't any question about that. Invited, Steve Novella invited Ray Hyman on. I invited Ray Hyman on. Won't come on to...
Just to interject and we can move on. You know, one reason the scientists might not go on is because podcasts aren't generally the medium to correct...
But he was on a podcast. He made his claim on a podcast. He made his claim on the Skeptical podcast. And they all sat around and, you know, chuckled. And he made some really disparaging comments about Dean Radin.
Sure, so but I don't Skeptic's think, Guide
just,
as...
You just said you said before, so let me tell you from my perspective in talking to a lot of parapsychology researchers... Hyman is not held in the kind of high esteem that you alluded to at all. So, you know, and so that's my position on it. He needs to answer up
to the claims that he made that don't seem to hold water, and that's where we're at. But let's move back on to, there's no need to monopolize the conversation on a guy who isn't here, but be happy to have him on here. But on the Wiseman thing, I have to say, you did a very good job of defending it. But I think the counter to that is that the whole purpose of science is to remove us from our subjectivity, to remove us from our biases. And we don't want to introduce biases back in. We don't want to say subjectively, what is an extraordinary claim? Subjectively, what is extraordinary proof? I mean, that's why we set up peer review. That's why we set up journals, so they can decide that. The proper mechanism is just exactly what you described. The Lancet publishes, the Lancet retracts. It's not appropriate for Wiseman to suggest that there is this other standard that's beyond science that is extraordinary. Now, I understand where he's coming from.
This is a big you're actually bringing up a big debate in the philosophy of science, not the kind of debates that scientists who publish research papers have, but the debates that philosophers of science have when they say, is science qua science enough? Is it enough just to kind of do our research without thinking of the implications of it? And that's a big ethical debate. I think when you're dealing with doing research that deals with these big questions, I think there's a responsibility there to make damn well sure you're on the right track, and not let your own biases, you're talking about removing your biases, but not let your own biases, like fear of death or desire to connect with deceased loved ones or any of that, let you play a little fast and loose with the evidence, especially when the implications of such widespread belief, in my view, I know you don't share this, are harmful to the mass of people. The implications of the claim, the belief that we survive death, to the extent that you believe that hook, line, and sinker, and we're removed from the science right now, you understand, to the extent that you believe that hook, line, and sinker, I think your life is diminished. That's a hard claim, and that's worth another debate. So if you're going to publish in a scientific paper, because the ancient religious texts, they've kind of lost their luster, right? And there's nothing groovier for someone than to say, aha, science says soul survives death, because when religion says it, it no longer matters because no one really buys religion, or at least a certain segment of our population, they'd rather get it from science than from religion. Well, if you're going to use the authority of science, in quotes, to support the claim that we have a soul and that it survives death, you got to be damn well sure that you're doing the best research. And so I'm all for higher standards of evidence, because when you jump through those hoops, mister, you change my mind. And I'm a person who's going around preaching survival of soul after death.
See, I was right with you there, cheering you on until the end. And then I think you proved my point, is when you venture into that realm of embracing the subjective measure of what's culturally appropriate for extraordinary, then I think you've lost your way. And that's where I think we have to hold on to science and value science so dearly, because it strips that away and says, no, we just want the data in the best form that we can get it, in its clearest path towards nudging a little bit closer to this truth. And if, as we're getting closer, it just gets further away, well, then we have to embrace that too, right? Because all this research might just reveal greater and greater mystery, not less mystery, and we have to embrace that as part of the process too. So that's why I'm against this idea that we need to layer on top of the scientific method and the scientific institution that we have for finding the truth. We have to layer on top of that something subjective called extraordinary claim and extraordinary proof, because it just gets into this silly debate. No, what you're saying is extraordinary. No, what you're saying is extraordinary. And we lose everything.
I'm all for evidence changing minds. That's the good part of science. You know, that's something I celebrate in science. You don't get that a whole lot in other ways of looking at the world.
Right.
But are you suggesting that the very best evidence is really pointing to the existence of the soul and the survival of the soul after death? And if you're suggesting that, and I think that's an audacious claim, Alex, but prove it to me, if not now, off the air or something, If you're suggesting that, then why the heck hasn't there just been a whole worldview shift among all scientists in this field? Or would you just chalk that up to how they're biased themselves and they're closed-minded to this plain-as-day research that's so conclusive? So what I'm asking is it conclusive or is it merely suggestive? Because there's a lot of stuff that's suggestive that is not borne out by further research.
I think it's highly, highly suggestive. And for me personally, it's convincing. It's to the point where it is convincing that that is a reality. Now, to your second point,
explain to me what the phrase "to me personally" it's convincing. Well, like, why is it convincing to you and not to other people? Does that have to do with your background, your own motivations, your own desires, or does it have to do with that you're just better at looking at the evidence than the other scientists?
Well, no, I was really speaking of it in terms of in the only way that we can. I mean, you were talking about how scientists like to couch things in careful terms and say highly suggestive and probabilistic and all that. But then at the end of the day, when each of us put our head on the pillow, we have our beliefs, and hopefully for many of us who are skeptical by nature, those beliefs are in flux. So they change. We can look at points in our lives when we believed or were convinced of one thing, and then we were changed and we're convinced of something else. So I think I'm talking about that more of as an internal weighing of the evidence. I am convinced of survival of consciousness by the evidence, because that's what drives me. That's what convinces me. But let me get to your...
But wait, weren't you convinced before you looked at the evidence, or were you like a skeptic of the survival of soul after death until you read these research papers?
I was unconvinced. I was very unconvinced, yes.
Well, that if that's true, I have no reason to doubt that it's true. That's at least a point in your favor. I'll give you that. Okay.
To your other point, and then I do want to talk about the $1 million challenge before our time runs out. And I appreciate you. One, I appreciate you engaging this dialogue. It's just everything that I could have hoped, and it's really kudos to you, because I have to tell you, as I try and engage folks who claim to be in the skeptical community, very few of them are really willing to engage in these questions, which, I tell you, I don't think these are tough questions. I think these are core questions, and I like the way that we are able to engage them, and I wish there was more of this kind of dialogue out there, not only between you and I, but between so many proponents, believers, and skeptics. But having said that little stump speech, let me get back to your other point in terms of why am I convinced and others are not convinced. Now, of course, I can't answer that completely, but I did get some interesting insights into that just by doing the Skeptico show and interviewing so many of these really smart people. Michael Persinger, who is just lauded by so many skeptics because they really haven't delved into his research very much and just know this God helmet thing and say, oh, the God helmet, yeah, there it is, God helmet, God helmet. Talk to Michael Persinger, and you'll see that in his lab, he believes that he's demonstrated telepathy. So he hooks two people up to the God helmet, and he sends, I think it's a light flash in one, and it appears in the EEG pattern of the person in the other room, and he's repeated it. So there he is saying, yeah, telepathy, anomalous communication, yeah, I've proven it. So, but anyways, you talk to someone like that, and then you get to their explanation for near-death experience. And as brilliant as this guy is, and as so much smarter than he is than I, his explanation doesn't hold water. And it only takes me a couple of phone calls to EEG experts who, the one I found is a very skeptical guy as well. It's such a paradox. So the guy I find to respond to Persinger's comment that the EEG is only measuring the surface of the brain, and that's why near-death experiencers with a flat EEG, that's what's going on. It's really deep in their brain. It took me, just like I say, a couple of phone calls. I found a guy who's one of the leading EEG experts in the country, and like I say, is skeptical of near-death experience. And he says, well, no, that's not true. That's not how EEG works. And there's numerous studies, both in animals and people, that would refute that. Now, there's a guy. So just unraveling that. So that guy doesn't know. And then, but that guy that I talked to, the EEG expert, he doesn't know the rest of the research. So I think, to answer your question, try and be more concise here. Folks just haven't engaged in the data. If you engage in the near-death experience data and you're really open-minded about it, you really can only come to one conclusion.
So we're, in a sense, back to square one, where you're chasing around certain claims and certain explanations, and you're telling me why you refute some, accept others. You remind me of the founder of, can I call it the cult that I was in as a young teenager, because you said, look, all these skeptics, they've not looked at the evidence. And some of these, even believers, when they disagree, they haven't looked at all the evidence. But Alex, you alone have looked at all the evidence, and or maybe
but
not
DJ, that's,
uniquely.
That's
but
not, that's not what I, that's not at all what I said. I don't know how else you could do it, DJ. What I've done and what I've tried to present on Skeptico is just looking at the best evidence on both sides of the issue. That's all I've done. I've had a lot of proponents of near-death experience who are solid researchers on the show. So, you know, I just had Dr. Jeffrey Long, who's published the most comprehensive near-death experience research ever, 10 years to compile. I had Dr. Peter Fenwick from the UK on. I had Dr. Penny Sartori on. So, but here is my point to respond to what you're saying is, these people don't disagree with me. They say, yeah, they're agreeing. They're saying, yeah, when anyone looks at all the evidence, this is the conclusion we're coming to. So this isn't my unique position.
Well, they disagree with one another about mechanism and process. And
Who disagrees on those things?
And
who disagrees?
And moreover, I'll just finish the thought. You also disagree with all of the skeptics. You say you, unlike all the skeptics, you've looked at all the evidence, and these skeptics just have not. So they find Persinger's explanation just too convenient. They pull it out of their hat and they say, magnets and the God part of the brain, whatever. That's the explanation, and I'm sticking to it. And you say, no, Alex, unique among all those folks.
Not unique. Not unique. DJ, I never claimed to be unique.
Well, you were contrasting yourself to all those skeptics. That's my point. if someone wants to know the answer to the question I asked you, which was, why do you believe it, but science doesn't, or science in general, except for whom I think you would admit would be a fringe group, if you don't want to use the word pseudoscientific group, but they're on the cutting edge of science, you might say, of believers in NDEs and the survival of the soul after death. Well, they're in the minority. So the majority of scientists who look into those questions don't believe as you, and your explanation is that they haven't looked at the evidence, but you have. That's the only thing. In my cheeky way, that was the comparison I was making with the founder of my beloved cult. You know,
we would have to unpack that and take another 15 minutes to do it, which I don't think is worthwhile. But I don't think you're characterizing it correctly. And we'll see. You can follow up with me and tell me how you think. And I'm happy to cooperate with you either on this show or on your new show for good reason. And explain to me how you would go about seeking the truth, which you stated was your goal. And I don't see any other way to do it. You look at folks who have published peer-reviewed articles on this topic, and you sort through them as best you can, finding the best experts to comment on those. That's the way that it's done. So I don't think my methodology is different than how you would do it. It's the only way to do it. How else would you?
But you're saying that it's different than how all the skeptics that you mentioned do it. You're saying or suggesting that none of them have looked at the evidence like you have. And I thought that was that took a little chutzpah, and I was just responding to it.
If you, DJ, or anyone listens to Skeptico, what you'll hear is not my pronouncements on these, but directly reaching the researchers. And that's what I've tried to do, is this threaded dialogue. So when Kevin Nelson claims REM intrusion explains near-death experience, I don't refute his claims. I call on another expert in the field, to like Dr. Jeffrey Long, to say, yeah, I know the guy well. I recruited the subjects for his experiment, actually. And if you look at the data, you'll find that 40% of the people going in didn't even have REM intrusion. So you have a point-by-point refutation of his claim. Now, then I said separately from that DJ.
Yeah, I know nothing about REM intrusion. Yeah,
okay,
I'm not.
But I'm saying I, as an individual, then listen to those two arguments and make my judgment and say, gee, this guy's explanation makes more sense to me, and that's the way I'm going. And I think that's how everyone does it. I don't find anything particularly cultish about that. To me, that's reasoned, critical thinking on these issues.
Boy, oh boy, I have to clarify something just because otherwise it would be a sandstorm. Easy to clarify. You are saying that's not how everyone does it. You're saying that's not how the skeptics do it. You're saying you look at all the evidence and the skeptics don't. So
no, I'm saying that's how anyone who really engages in critical thinking does it.
And by implication, you're saying all those skeptics you mentioned aren't engaging in critical thinking. I was kind of challenging that view because it's a cheeky it takes some balls to say, unlike all these other researchers, I'm looking at the evidence and they're not. Okay, that's point one. But point two, about the cult comment, in no sense was I saying you are cultic or like you're in a cult. Okay, so don't walk away from our conversation saying, my God, DJ said I was like a cult leader, you know?
No, I heard what you said, and I don't think it really stands up. But let's move on because we've really gone for a long time
yeah.
here. And I do want to talk about the $1 million challenge. And I want to hear where you're going with it and where you plan on taking it. And I heard in another show, and I think it was on Steve Novella's show, that you mentioned that it is more of a rhetorical prize than a real prize. I think I want to make sure that you understand the criticisms of the $1 million challenge. And
before you get to those, I just want to address what you just said. I don't want to let that stand. There is a rhetorical aspect of that, but rhetorical in the sense that it is public. It's for public speech, not rhetorical in the sense that oftentimes in common usage you say, oh, I didn't really mean that. That was rhetorical. I don't mean rhetorical in that sense. So rhetoric, you know, which is public persuasion, that's in the sense that the $1 million challenge is a PR vehicle to raise consciousness or awareness of the public about their responsibilities to take these claims seriously enough to look at the evidence and not buy them hook, line, and sinker without looking at the evidence. And also, it's a chief means for us to challenge irresponsible claimants. So that hopefully fleshes out what you heard on Novella's show. The million dollar challenge is real. There's $1 million for the asking. If anyone can show evidence of their claims, supernatural, paranormal, parapsychological, pseudos, kind of the kinds of claims that we would challenges skeptics, if you can prove us wrong, the million is yours. And it's a real million. It's not just a PR vehicle. Of course, I fully acknowledge that as an educational nonprofit, we are using the $1 million challenge as a way to get public attention on these matters or to do public relations about these matters. And as such, it's really the chief means that we do that.
Yeah, but this isn't like the X Prize or anything. This isn't going to send rockets into space or build more fuel-efficient cars. And it isn't. The problem is it isn't intended to advance anything. It's just intended to draw attention to your scientific position, which in and of itself I think is problematic. Why do we need a position? We've just had this very interesting, engaging dialogue for an hour on real science. I can't imagine in the way that the JREF $1 million challenge has been used that $1 million challenge would ever come into play on any of the topics we've talked about or any of the topics, you know, we just mentioned Michael Persinger proving him thinking that in his laboratory he's proven telepathy. I can't ever imagine him approaching JREF on a scientific basis and saying, hey, I've established this. Go ahead. Let's set up the terms for my challenge.
If he doesn't, I wonder why he doesn't. You know, Persinger has some interesting things to say. And
because isn't scientific legitimacy to the JREF $1 million challenge. I've talked to all these guys. None of them think it's legitimate. And maybe you can change that. Maybe as the new president and with your openness and your integrity, maybe you can usher in a new era where it does become something like the XPRIZE. But right now...
Well, a few things on the $1 million challenge, and I think you have a good understanding of where we've gone with it and where we want to go with it. I want to flesh that out a bit. One, you're right. It is not... how science gets done. The $1 million challenge is a $1 million prize or offer that the JREF makes available to claimants, many of or most of whom aren't scientists or approaching this in the spirit of science. They're paranormal or psychic some other kind of claimant, you know, a housewife who thinks she has the ability to douse, and she got some media attention or something, and she's making a buck on it, and we say, prove it. If you do, you get our million. If she says, oh, no, I don't want the million, well, we have to question motives or be suspicious there. If everything's on the table and we say, no, it will be by mutually agreed upon scientific conditions that we can test these sorts of claims. You're right that a scientist in a lab looking at some of these questions may, for overdetermined reasons, not approach the JREF for that $1 million. One of which is that's not generally how science is done. You don't try to prove a scientific claim in order to get $1 million. You publish something in a peer-reviewed journal. That's how science is done. Another reason is that the standards of evidence are actually lower in some of the sciences, like Richard Weissman mentioned in that quote, than they would be for the $1 million. Because if we're going to give $1 million, and man, let me just tell you, although some skeptics may disagree with me on this, I would love to award the $1 million to someone. I think it would be a great day for science if someone proved conclusively some paranormal or psychic claim. Not only would the $1 million be well spent, but it would change the world as we know it. It would change physics. It would change. There'd be a Nobel Prize awarded for it. You know, if a person passed the preliminary tests and then many of which you have tens of thousands of dollars as awards or prizes. And then pass the $1 million challenge, man, it would change everything. And I'd love the JREF to be part of that. It just so happens after decades of looking into this sort of stuff as individual researchers and then the last 13 years of the James Randi Educational Foundation, we have not found any evidence to support the claims. In fact, the vast majority... I hope this changes, and this is one of the things we want to change, but heretofore, the vast majority of people who have tried out for the $1 million challenge just, have not even really gotten past phase one, so to speak. They haven't shown really any reason to advance, and often by their own admission, they say, oh, well, I just had a bad day. I know I got that completely wrong. And they kind of move on with their lives. So
DJ, I think, if you can raise the $1 million challenge to the level that you're talking about and bring transparency and openness in the way that you're talking about it, I think you will have done a great service to the skeptical community in general and might even turn this thing into a valuable tool. I think when you get to that point, it'll be really interesting to see what happens, because that's the other criticism. My criticism of it is that it isn't really scientific, and it's sometimes used by skeptics in an inappropriate way to claim that that scientists who are making claims that seem to refute some of the skeptical positions, well, that they're not really, they're not to be believed because they haven't stepped forward for the $1 million challenge. I think the way you framed it up, I think it is very is very true and very accurate, and it's a useful tool, and you're the guy to do.
Let me just rejoin to this. The criticism you just offered of the $1 million challenge is legit. If some people conceive of the $1 million challenge as the way science works. In other words, to advance our scientific understanding in this field, be challenged for $1 million. Well, that, you know, science is not a cage match, despite the fact that you put some big personality scientists in a room and they fight. Science doesn't work that way. The $1 million challenge is done in the spirit of science. It's done looking at the evidence, but it is a vehicle of a nonprofit educational foundation to raise public consciousness and awareness about these important questions. Leading scientists who are skeptics, kind of on our side of the fence, Ray Hyman is one of them, shares those exact criticisms of the $1 million challenge. I think they're legit, but I'm not, you know, I'm unapologetic about that. You know, we're not a scientific body. We're not a we don't have teams of scientists in the employ of the JREF. We're a nonprofit educational foundation that cares about advancing critical thinking in society, and we just so happen to put $1 million of our dollars on the table to anyone who can prove, under mutually agreed upon scientific conditions, his or her supernatural or paranormal claim. Full
Great.
Stop.
What about openness? What about openness and transparency? I think you alluded to the fact that, well, tell us, that's another criticism that's been levied that you can address. Is that something you will address?
Well, I'm proud of the transparency so far, and we want there to be even more transparency in the following ways. So claimants, when they apply, in short order, although I'm kind of letting the cat out of the bag, in the months ahead, we want to have a kind of a running public display of all the claimants and
Excellent.
The progress of their challenges
Excellent.
And their applications. We want to automate the application process because just aren't following the very basic guidelines of the application process. So we're going to have hopefully some more automation in the application process. If you think you have a talent, ability, a supernatural power, if you think your little gizmo magnetically ages wine to make it indistinguishable from a 40-year-old Merlot, or you think that you have an electronic gadget that increases your ESP, whatever the claim, the supernatural or paranormal claim, you fill out the application and begin the process to go after this $1 million. We think it's going to be an even better tool than it's been in the past to get the best claimants out there and going for the $1 million. And if you also notice that we look around and challenge certain claimants in our society with the $1 million, I think that will be an important new direction as well. So one example here, Alex, is just off the top of my head. There are a number of nursing schools, nursing colleges in the United States that I think most skeptics would be appalled at finding out, and many fair-minded people who might not self-identify as skeptics would be appalled to find out they teach as part of their medical curricula what's called healing touch.
Therapeutic touch.
Therapeutic touch. Nurses to go into the patient's bedside and, you know,
best
Gingerly.
Investigated with science, not with the $1 million challenge. Again, I'm with you 100%. I think moving things in the direction
of openness needs to be
does.
Investigated. It needs to be investigated with science. You're right. And I think that there hasn't been enough investigation to merit being so widely applied.
I think it's just a popular
thing. But I'll just finish this one. I'll just finish this one point. If a claimant says, what I'm doing has more than palliative effect, what medical intervention I'm doing, supernatural medical intervention I'm doing, can help heal you, I love the idea of saying, calling some of these people who are making you know, a big buck on these sorts of claims, calling them out, or a nationally prominent psychic.
Well, DJ, call out the nationally... Hold on. You got to be able to separate this out. Again, I'm with you. I love everything you're saying up until you get to a point. Look it. Do you really care about... the nationally prominent skeptic, yeah, draw him out. The televangelist,
the psychic, yeah.
draw him out. You'll never get him to agree to it, but that's fine. But when you start talking about therapeutic touch, hey, if it's real... The only way you're ever going to know is through some study done over years, hundreds of patients, multiple kinds of controls to diminish the scientific question down to this gag gift of scientific prizes, I think is a detriment to science. I think you have to be really careful how you use that tool. Why not just do what you said?
You're absolutely right that the way to really ferret out the truth about therapeutic touch is decades, years, if not decades, of research. I don't think that research has been done, yet it's being, you know, it's being proffered at all of these nursing colleges. And so a way for us as an educational nonprofit in the public's interest to raise awareness about this is maybe to challenge practitioners who are making money on something that science says is as of yet untested. Now, you're right. They will likely say, oh, leave me alone. My life was fine until you started bothering me. You know, I'm a nice nurse or a nice dean of a nursing college.
But that's not the point. The point is that, as you just admitted, the vehicle that you have isn't the right vehicle to establish whether Jane Doe, therapeutic touch practitioner, is efficacious in what she does.
But so it's a great vehicle to raise the public's awareness about these questions, and so...
But not if it's not fair in seeking the truth, which goes back to an hour ago, what we said you're all about. If you're really all about seeking the truth, then you have to hold to that and not be tempted to using some kind of trick or stunt that might draw attention but doesn't really nudge us closer to the truth. Look, do what you just said for the $1 million challenge and it'll be a huge step forward. You'll have hundreds of applicants. They'll be online for everyone to review. People will be able to see how they go through the process, whether they're treated fairly. That's all you need to do. You don't need to go call anybody out.
Well,
that's the problem with the Pegasus Award and how it's been so misused.
Is a kind of funny way that the JREF has historically highlighted some nonsense. But you're right. The $1 million challenge is not going to be the only way that new research is advanced in some of these fields. In fact, the $1 million challenge does not fuel new research. What it does is challenge existing claims. So if someone is making an unsubstantiated claim, I think they're fair game. And in the end, that engagement actually advances the truth-seeking we're all talking about, because we're able to engage on those claims rather than just kind of ignoring it or saying, well, hopefully science will get around to it at some point and look into these claims. So therapeutic touch is the example. I think the $1 million challenge could, in fact, hasten science as the big behemoth institution it is into substantiating or otherwise evaluating therapeutic touch claims, and if they can't be substantiated, there's no reason in the world that such services should be offered and even paid for by some insurance companies in nursing colleges across the United States.
Complicated issue. It's where we really differ in terms of what really truly advances science and science education. And I just, as in a final thought, because it was brought up, you know, the problem with the Pegasus Award is we don't need to be calling out and ridiculing scientists because we don't agree with their ideas. If you find methods that are in error or something like that, you know, the one that we've kind of dug into the furthest was, you know, the Pegasus Award was given to Rupert Sheldrake. And he's kind of a friend of the show, has been on many times on Skeptico, but you know, just independently. I had a student at the University of London who did a dissertation. I didn't know where this kid was coming from, but he calls me up. He's doing a dissertation on Rupert Sheldrake and finds what we all who've looked into it know is that he was treated very unfairly, not just by the skeptical community, but by the scientific community in general. So is there ever a retraction? Is the Pigasus Award ever proven wrong? They were certainly wrong about Charles Tart. They were certainly wrong about Rupert Sheldrake. Is there ever any room for correcting mistakes? And that's the problem. That's where it doesn't advance science. It doesn't advance science education. That's where JREF just gets people polarized and entrenched and just, you know, feeds the beast of uncritical thinking disguised as skepticism.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Sheldrake's kind of personal narrative, his intellectual history and his engagement with other folks in his field to be able to agree with you or not, but you were conflating, in my view, his reception in science with his getting an award from a nonprofit that poked fun at him a little. The Pigasus does that. The Pigasus Awards poke fun at what the JREF thinks are irresponsible researchers or others who aren't going in the direction we think good science goes, but, you know, that's another show, that's another debate. It is not certainly the chief means by which we raise awareness about this, these sorts of issues, you know, there are different approaches for different audiences. You might engage in high-minded research sometimes, and you might have laugh-a-minute kind of poking fun of some other folks in other times, and both approaches are valid for different audiences. You know, here's an example. James Randi refers to paranormalists as peddlers of woo-woo, right? That's a term that's taken off. A lot of people use that term. It is somewhat disparaging, I think, but there's room and reason to sometimes disparage irresponsible claimants. If you're going to engage in the world of science, you don't call someone you disagree with, you know, a peddler of woo-woo. But the JREF doesn't only engage in the world of science. We try to educate the public about claims. And when talking with ordinary everyday folks, you use a different approach that might have more of a promise to reach new publics, to have more impact. So just as Richard Dawkins, to take an example, may sometimes refer to the religious as faith heads, which is kind of disparaging, he'll other times engage in a high-minded debate with a believer. And it, you know, just goes to show you there are different approaches for different, you know, for different times.
Boy, DJ, you know, you've circled us back now to the beginning of this interview and my question, are you ready for this? And I don't know, I just greatly admire the openness that you're bringing to this and the intellectual force you're bringing to it. But now, having said that, I have to say that last part of your argument, I think completely falls apart. In the area of the competition for the cultural mindset, Dawkins is at fair game to square off with believers when they're talking about ideas and philosophies. In the area of science, James Randi is completely inappropriate to use those kind of disparaging comments when what we're really trying to do is get away from that and get down to the data. What we really want to do is engage in substantive dialogue like we've just begun to do here about the data, about the best way to approach the data, the best way to critically think about the data, and there doesn't have to be a lot of personality involved.
Well, Alex, the debate you're talking about there being between the skeptical community and the paranormal, call it community, or the believer community, or whatever, I haven't really come up with a term to describe your side of the fence, but the debate between those two communities is also the same debate that is now happening and should happen within the skeptical community. So to what extent do we feel comfortable telling someone we think is full of it that they are full of it, or do we kind of complain in a scientific way and say, oh, the evidence doesn't bear out your conclusion, etc.
It's not a matter of semantics, and it's not a matter of political correctness. It's about engaging with the data. So, you know, DJ, we engaged a little bit on the near-death experience data. The only way to engage it is the way that we talked about. You take the best research you can find, and you compare and contrast, you weigh the evidence, you critically think about it, and you arrive at some level of certainty about your conclusion. That's it. It's real simple, and that's what we're all really, I think, trying to do, those of us who are skeptical but open-minded.
And that's the direction the JREF is going. I think that's the heritage of the JREF thus far, and we're only going to build on that and move further in this direction. The evidence is ultimately what matters to an educational foundation. That's what matters first and foremost, but other things also matter to an educational nonprofit, and that is its mission to educate the public about critical thinking methods and what the best science says about these sorts of claims. So the evidence is so important, but also the way that you engage the public. So hence our discussion on strategy as opposed to just talking about the evidence. When you're a researcher in your lab, you don't have to ever think about strategy. You just think about the research, the evidence. But when you're trying to bring that evidence to a wide audience and you're trying to educate the public about what the science says or what the best evidence says about these sorts of claims, then you have to not only think about the evidence but also about the strategy. And I'm here to express to you that the JREF is thinking about those strategies even as we hold our commitment to the evidence as utmost.
Well, DJ, you might just be the best hope for the skeptical community going forward. And we certainly, I certainly have to commend JREF for hiring you. It was a great, great find. And we certainly wish you the best of luck. Tell us real quickly what's coming up for you and for JREF in the near future that
okay, I'll tell you that. And I'll also say that kind of ringing endorsement is, just what it will take to get all the skeptics say, oh, my God, did we hire a plant from the paranormal community?
Cheer you to death, right?
Exactly. You know, and in fact, I guess I will share this anecdote. When I first got started with the Center for Inquiry a decade ago, I kid you not, Alex, a rumor went around, small circle of folks, that I was actually a plant from the religious right. So I can't wait to brace myself for possibility of people thinking, my God, Alex likes DJ so much, DJ must be a paranormalist, you know? So
you'll get it, I'm sure.
Okay, what's coming up next? Well, of course, in March, the JREF is having its Skeptics of the Caribbean cruise, or Caribbean, if you're thinking Pirates of the Caribbean, where Randy and myself and others, along with a group of 80 or 90 skeptics, kind of grassroots skeptics folks, are going to take a 10-day cruise in the Caribbean. That sounds like a vacation, because it is, but it's also a great way for skeptics to get together, build community, talk about these issues. And I'll tell you, just on the previous point you were talking about, when we were getting into strategy versus just looking at the evidence, the thing that excites me most about the skeptical world right now is this burgeoning grassroots movement, the skeptics in the pub everywhere, where evidence is what's debated and talked about. You would be welcome at any one of these across the country, Alex. Even as a believer, you show up, you say, I want to talk about NDEs, and here's my evidence for it. These are open-minded inquirers who really want to engage. You're not going to be, you know, thrown out of the joint. Because you care about the questions, you belong. Now, it just so happens that the people who come to these sorts of events are skeptics, so there's a community-building aspect as well. What else is on the horizon? Well, of course, there's the amazing meeting this July. We think it will be our largest yet. The lineup is, many of us think it's the best lineup we've had in years, if ever, at the amazing meeting in Las Vegas. We've recently expanded conferences internationally into the UK and later this year into Australia. At the amazing meeting in Vegas this July, it looks like we're going to have a big to-do as regards the million-dollar challenge. Hell, maybe at one of these sorts of meetings or one of our regional things, we get you involved to some extent, because it'd be fun to engage, and not only fun, but I think it would advance what we both care about, which are the questions.
I'd be happy to be part of the loyal opposition.
You said that just like we planned on. Just joking.
Well, DJ, certainly best of luck with that going forward. And again, thank you so much for not only joining me today, but for representing the kind of dialogue that can be difficult, but can still advance critical thinking. And I hope that's what we did today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alex. Fun conversation as usual.
Thanks again to DJ Grothy for joining me today on Skeptico. Really enjoyed the interview. If you'd like more information about the show and some of the topics we talked about, please visit the Skeptico website. That's at SKEPTIKO. You'll find links to all our previous shows, links to me where you can connect with me on Facebook or on Twitter, or drop me an email. Love to hear from you as always. And you'll also find a link to our forums there where you can interact with other Skeptico listeners. Much more to come on future episodes, including some follow-ups on some of the topics that were raised today. That's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, bye for now.